We're starting here on the bottom, Nun Gimel Amud Bet, 12 lines up. Amar Rav Ashi, Kavina Bei Rav Kahana, when we were by Rav Kahana, Aitu Kaman Hayreya. They brought this set of lungs to us. Dichavu Meit Vela, Yatzvo Shapir. When they set it down, or you just let it hang out there, it seemed like everything was fine. Vichiavu Matlula, but when you hung it up, or you suspended it, Hava, and here obviously there's an issue with the Girsa, Latata Venafla, Tilhei. There were little pieces that came off of it. It was decomposed, and little things started to fall off of the lungs after you hung them up. Vitarifnala, and we made it a treifa, midarabhuna, braid the Rav Yeshua. As we saw earlier in the staff, that kol arufet, gordo. If anything that the rufet can cut off, like if he was trying to make it into healthy skin, he would take off this part because it was dead, or it was decomposed skin. That's true on the outside. Externally, it's also true of the organs internally. Then we view it as if it's not there. So now, if you look at the lungs as if they're not there, a cow missing its lungs is not kasher. So that's why he made it into a treifa. Rav Nachman Amar, Bekotz, when we're dealing with a needle or any sharp object, ad shitina kev lachlal, it's until it goes all the way into the internal side of the animal. Rashi explains over here, it's important, aval higia lachlal, once it reaches the internal area of the organs, Yesh lachush, shema nikvu adakim. At that point, we think that it might have punctured something inside. So the needle or whatever it is coming from the external side is not problematic until it reaches into that area of the sensitive organs. Once it reaches into that area of the sensitive organs, then even though it's floating around and it hasn't punctured anything, we don't see it punctured anything, nevertheless it's problematic, because Rashi says, if shar, yipnei she'ein nekev dak nikarben, you can't find such a needle-sized hole inside of the intestines. It's just too hard to check for it. And therefore, you got to assume if there's a needle in that area that it might have done something that hurt the internal organs that would make it into a treifa. Bidrusa, mishiadim basar keneged bnei ma'ayim. And when it comes to a drusa, that was attacked by another animal, and now we're worried about the ZRA, we're worried about the possibility of some sort of venom, poison that's been inserted to the animal that's going to cause a problem, then it has to be mishi adim. It becomes redness, or redness spreads. Keneged bnei me'ayim, opposite those internal organs. Over here, the bnei me'ayim, and we'll see in a second in the Gemara which of the internal organs is included in this. But the assumption is that at least the digestive system is included in this. According to Chazal, the red would be an indication of the venom of the poison spreading there. The way that we had explained it, that possibly it was the bacteria that was caught under the nails of the animal that caused that type of infection that could spread if it hit the internal organs, then the redness would be a sign of that infection. And as we saw above, the drusa shamru, according to Rashi, is only in the case of a safek drusa, although the Bali and Tosafot think that the bidika works even when we have a vadai drusa. And then he actually tries to say that Rashi might even agree that by a vadai drusa you can check it as well. Just by a safek drusa you need to check everywhere because of the safek. By vadai drusa, you actually know where to check, and that's why Rashi claims the case here is a safek drusa, because you're checking that large area. Rav Zvid matnei hachi, vidrusa mishiadim basar keneged bnei me'ayim. He wrote it this way, when it comes to drusa, similar to what Rav Nachman said, that it has to become red, opposite the area of the bnei me'ayim. Bisimanim achiadim usimanim atzmam. On the other hand, when it comes to the simanim, we do not think that there is a problem until the simanim themselves become red. That was the difference, actually, that we saw previously in this daf. The question is whether simanim are affected by the venom. The simanim are much stronger. They have a certain amount of ability to survive against that type of, whether it's venomous or bacterial problem that is now infecting the animal. So when it hits the bnei me'ayim, those internal organs are much more sensitive. So there, if it's already red external to them, then we worry about it penetrating and reaching those organs themselves. By the simanim, there was a daya that the simanim are not affected at all by this. But here he has somewhat of a compromise position, which is, if it's red outside of the simanim, meaning in the neck area, then we don't worry about it. But if the simanim themselves have turned red, that means that it's already infected or it's already impacted those organs, and therefore it'll be an issue. And as Rashi says over here, the rov simanim kashim heim. Majority of the simanim are kashim, ve'in eris sholeit behem. And the venom doesn't have the ability to affect them, or if you say it's the bacterial infection, until it actually infects them or affects them, We're not going to worry about it. Even though the external skin around it seems to be affected by it, we're not going to worry about the simanim till they themselves are affected by it. But by the b'nei me'ayim, even the flesh or the area around it is enough to deem it to be a problem or an issue of treifa. Amar Rav Papi, by Rav Bibi bar Abayi, veshet nikubato b'mashu. When it comes to the esophagus, we've already established that even the smallest puncture, the smallest hole, makes it into a treifa. Drusato b'mashu. And therefore, similarly, when it is a drusa, even the smallest amount will cause a problem. We also established that earlier when you have to check for redness on the esophagus and you have to turn it inside out because the external part of the esophagus was a red lining. The internal was white and you have to check the internal side to make sure that there was no redness over there. But both of those were b'mashinu. Kane, when it comes to the trachea, nikuvato b'ki isar. That we already established that when it is punctured, there's something missing from it. It has to be the size of an isar. Drusato bikamo. But we don't have any evidence or previous knowledge about, from what we've seen so far, as to what the din of a drusa is vis-a-vis the trachea. The trachea obviously has a higher threshold under what makes it into a trefa. The vesh, it's a mashu and a mashuhu, so there's not really much room for discussion. But by the trachea, where you need to have a chaser by kasaj and isar, then maybe by drusa there's also a higher threshold or higher standard. After you asked the question, he answered it himself. Doesn't matter. When it comes to the problem of drusa, it is a mashuhu. Of course, for the veshet, but even for the trachea as well. My taima. The reason being, ziharei mikla koli va'azil. The problem is that the venom or the bacterial infection spreads. It's not something that is static. It's not something that where you find a little bit of it and that's where it's going to stay. As soon as it comes and infects the animal, then it's going to continue to spread inside of that. So once the trachea is already infected, you can assume it's going to spread through the trachea and it's going to cause a bigger problem. So even the smallest amount already makes it into a treifa. Seen before, there's a machloket rishonim as to what exactly the issue is with mikla koli, which is that is the problem of the venom and the drusa, whether it's, or this bacterial infection, the fact that it's actually going to cause a puncture in the organ, meaning that you're going to get a hole there, and a nekev is something that is a treifa. So is that what we're worried about, that eventually it'll create a nekev there? Or is there inherently a problem with this venom or this bacterial infection, which means even without a hole, the infection itself causes a decomposition or a deterioration of that organ, and that's the problem. So we've seen before there's a machloket rishonim. Rashi has somewhat of a stira in a number of places where he explains it as to whether the issue is just the infection itself or it's the hole that's created by it. The Rishonim discuss what is the issue, and we've already addressed that. Yotiv Rav Yitzchak bar Shmuel bar Marta, Kameder of Nachman. Yotiv Kamar, Drusa Shamru, Tzricha B'dika K'neged B'nei Me'ayim. When you have an animal that is a drusa and you need to check it, then that checking is done K'neged B'nei Me'ayim, in the area opposite the internal organs. The question of what b'nei me'ayim means is going to be determined by the next statement of the Gemara, and it turns out to be a machloket Rashi and Tosafot. Amar le Rav Nachman, so Rav Nachman responds to him, Elokim, by the name of God, thinking Shua, Mori ba Rav, this is the halacha that Rav paskin, mikapa v'ad atmo. From the kapa, literally means like from the pan until the atmo, until the hip or the femur. My kapo. What is the kapo? What is the pan that they're speaking about? Ilema kapo diodo. If you say it's speaking about the scapula, which is the shoulder blade. If you look at the picture of the shoulder blade in the animal, and it has like a long shape with an end to it that's wide. It has like a sort of a pan type shape to it in the scapula. This is where Tosfot and Rashi argue about what's the b'nei me'ayim. Rashi over here says, that means that it includes everything. The scapula, where it attaches to the foreleg of the animal. So if I start from there, and then I go to the femur, I go to the hip, that means I've covered all the internal organs from front to back. And so therefore Rashi says over here that that would include the rea, the kaved, the lungs, the liver, and all of the intestinal or digestive system. It'd be the entire stretch across there. And Rashi's proof is from the fact that the Mishnah later on, which he quotes over here, Nun Vav Amud Bet, says, Nechmeru b'nei ma'eha, when it says b'nei me'ayim over there, it means all the internal organs, from front to back. So that would include the lungs and the liver. Now, the Balei HaTosafot disagree, and their main point is that Lashon HaMishnah or Latanaim is different than the Lashon HaAmoraim. Rashi bringing a proof from a Mishnah that B'nai Ma'ayim means all the internal organs. He says, that's true of the Lashon HaMishnah, the Lashon HaTanaim. It is not true of the Amoraim. When the Amoraim use the term B'nai Ma'ayim, they mean the organs that deal with the digestive system, that which is beyond the lungs and the liver. That's generally the rear organs or towards the back. And he does that by saying that the kappa, when we're speaking about the scapula over here, or the shoulder blade over here, Rashi counted it from the location where it connects to the foreleg of the animal. So that gives you that whole front area. If you take it from the top of the scapula, from the top of the shoulder blade, and then go from there back to the hip or the femur, there you only cover the internal organs, excluding that of the lungs and the kaved and the liver. And that's what the Balei HaTosafot think, that B'nai Ma'ayim is including. That goes back to something also that we saw before, where the necessity for a check in these animals, one opinion was B'nai Ma'ayim, and then the next opinion was et ha-halal kulo, the entire cavity. The entire cavity would sound like the area that includes also the liver and the lungs. And that's why the Balei HaTosafot think that B'nai Ma'ayim cover a smaller area than the kol ha-halal kulo. And that's what they should have said here, the Balei HaTosafot would say, if they meant everything. If they meant everything, they should have used a different terminology. And therefore, you have this machloket Rashi and Tosafot as to what it's referring to. So, ilayim at the kap of the other, ainu keneged b'nei ma'ayim. If it was just from the scapula to the back, then that would be equivalent to b'nei ma'ayim that was stated by Rav Yitzchak bar Shmuel, bar Marta. And then what is Rav Nachman adding? So it has to be a greater area that he's adding, because he disagrees with him. Now the Gemara says, ela mikapa de mocha ad atma. The kappa that we're speaking about here, this pan, or whether it's a spoon, or whatever you think the shape of the bone that they're speaking about, we're not speaking about the shoulder blade or the scapula, we're actually speaking about the skull, or the cranium, which is also bowl-like in shape. It has the shape of a spoon or a bowl, it has a receptacle upside down, but it has it there, and that's what the reference is, which means from the head until the hip. So that's the area that you need to check, which is obviously a much larger area, and covers all of the area that we'd have expected to cover when you have to check for issues of drusa. And that's what Rashi says, that tainu kol ha-halal, that includes all the cavity, which means all the internal organs, av keneged ha-simanim, and keneged the simanim, which we just saw before, was an issue, that you have to check the simanim, whether it means opposite simanim or the simanim themselves, but there is at least a check that needs to be done by the simanim as well, and that covers that entire area. There is a residual machloket Rishonim about how far up on the head you have to check. Which means that, does it mean from the back of the cranium down is where you check? Or does it include the brain itself, or that area of the head by the skull? Does that need to be checked as well? That would depend on where you think when it says kappa de mocha, where along that skull or cranium do you start? Is it from the rear or from the front of it? And then that would determine whether it includes the brain itself or that area of the brain itself as well. Kisalik Rav Chiya bar Yosef. When Rav Chiya bar Yosef went up to Eretz Yisrael, Ashkechinu l'Rav Yochanan v'Esh Lakish, the Yatvei v'Kamrei, they were sitting and saying, Drusa Shamru, Srichat B'diga K'neged B'nei Ma'ayim. Similar Mesorah that we saw from Rav Yitzchak bar Shmuel bar Marta, that you need to check K'neged B'nei Ma'ayim, the internal organs. Again, Rashi and Tosafot disagree as to what extent of B'nei Ma'ayim is. Amar Elohu, so he says to them, Elohim, Mori Barav Mikafa Be'adatma. He brings the same Mesorah that Rav Nachman had. Rav Chiya bar Yosef is now bringing that to Eretz Yisrael, to Rav Yochanan Esh Lakish. The conversation here is intriguing beyond belief here, because now you get a sense of what the shiur that Rabbi gave in Eretz Yisrael was like in terms of both hierarchy, the individuals that were there, and the interaction or interplay between them. Amalei Esh Lakish, Manu Rav U Manu Rav, people keep quoting things from this guy Rav, and I never heard of this guy Rav. Who is this guy Rav? This Mesorah was brought here. And every time they keep bringing us Mesorah from Bavel, and the name of this guy Rav, and I have no clue who he is. So Amar Rav Yochanan, Benon Hirale, the Oto Talmid, Shishimei, Shid Rabbi Rabo, Ve Rabbi Chia. You don't remember that Talmid, that superstar Talmid in the front of the class, that was in service of Rabbi Rabba, referring to Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, the great Rabbi, and Rabbi Chia. Rabbi Chia, who is also a Talmid Muvok of Rabbi, almost a Talmid Chaber of Rabbi. He was the uncle of Rav, And Rav was a protege both to Rabbi Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, as well as Rabbi Chia, his uncle. He learned by both of them. And then he went off to Bavel afterwards. So Rabbi Yochanan says to Rishakish, you don't remember that superstar in the front of the class that was in service of both of these great Talmid Chachamim? Ve'elukim, kol otan shanim shishimesh oto tamid b'yeshiva, as long as he was in the yeshiva, meaning Rav was in the yeshiva, anishimashti b'amida. He sat in front of the big guns, in front of the class. I had to stand, Rabbi Yochanan says, which gives you a sense of the hierarchy. Those students that were permitted to sit in front of the Rebbeim were the students in the front of the class. They were the Tzuber, the Rabbona, the top of the class. Us guys who were youngsters in this year, and we were in the way back, we had to stand. We weren't able to sit down. Rabbi Yochanan says about himself that while I was in the shiur of Rabbi, which first of all tells you that Rabbi Yochanan was in Rabbi's shiur when he was very young. Rabbi Yochanan was there before he was the great Rabbi Yochanan. So he did see Rabbi. He did see Rav as well. But they were clearly older than him. Rav certainly was older than him and far more advanced than he was at the time. And he's sitting in the front of the shiur and eventually goes off to Bavel to the point where Reish Lakish doesn't even remember that he sat there with Rav in the shiur. And Rabbi Yochanan is trying to jog his memory and say, listen, we were there together. We used to stand in the back of the shiur, and Rav was up in the front, sitting there with the big guns. So he says, Uman Gavar, who Gavar Bekula. And this individual, whatever he is, Gadolin, he knows everything. Meaning that he is a Talmud Chacham of the top echelon. He knows everything, and he's great in Torah and Gemilut Chassidim. I mean, he's the real thing, Rav. This is how Rabbi Yochanan is speaking to Reish Lakish. Miyad Patach Reish Lakish. That they said over something in his name. It's not clear whether Reish Lakish actually did remember him and then was saying this, or that he didn't remember him, but now that he had the background as to who Rav was, he's saying, and then he brings a memra that is in the name of Rav. If the trachea is detached and it is also shechted, it's kshera. We have an animal in front of us. We see that the trachea is cut, but we also see it's detached from the lower jaw. It's detached from its location. That's what's called ikur. Rashi says ikur is a trefa because it's inherently a trefa. The Bahag says that ikur is a trefa, not because there's anything inherently wrong, but you can't shech an ikur. That's the law of the Moshe Mitzrayim. Once there's ikur, you can't do shechita. But for whatever reason, once it's detached, the trachea, from the lower jaw, then the shechita is not a good shechita. Because if it was detached, it is impossible to do a shechita. Now that, according to Rashi, means that when the trachea detaches from the point where it's attached to the lower jaw, it will slide down. There's a huge amount of pressure on the trachea because it's being pulled in both directions. There's pulling from the jaw side and there's pulling from the lung side. Generally, it's attached on both ends, and that holds it in place, so it has to have a certain flexibility expansion to it to allow it to extend its head, to move its head, has a certain amount of flexibility. But there's a decent amount of pressure on that, and therefore, if it detached from the lower jaw, it would slide down. So now, if you try to shecht it, when you go in there and shecht it, you're not going to cross the trachea. The trachea won't be there anymore. It's going to be too far down. It's going to be pulled towards the lung side. That's how Rashi reads it. The other hand, the Rambam believes that the shmuta over here is the fact that once it's detached, you don't have counter pressure for the shechita. When you try to shech something, and it's moving at the same time you're cutting it, it's impossible to cut. You need something to stabilize it in order for you to cut something like that. And if it's not attached, it's not going to be stabilized or stiff enough for you to cut through it. And that's the problem with shmuta. So the problem is that it must have been, this is the conclusion that we're saying from Rav's statement, is that the shmuta happened after the shechita. If the shmuta had happened before the shechita, then, by definition, you wouldn't have been able to do the shechita, according to Rashi, because the trachea is not there when you cut in. It's just not going to be there. According to the Rambam, because you can't stabilize it in order to do the shechita. So by definition, if you see a trachea that's cut, and it's also shmuta, the cut happened first, and it was pulled out afterwards, or got detached after the shechita, and therefore it is ksheira. That's what the statement of Rav is. Shmuta v'shechita, ksheira. Rabbi Yochanan Omer, yavi v'yakif. You bring another one. So now, that's a little controversial, we'll see in a second, because from the Pashtut here, it sounds like you have to bring another animal, and then you do the same thing and see what it looks like. You cut a trachea after it's detached, or before it's detached, and you see if they look similar. The type of cut, the amount of redness, the type of blood flow that you see there. What does it look like when it's before or after it's been detached? So you do a simulation, and then you figure out through the simulation if it is okay. But over here, it sounds like Yavi means that you should bring another animal in order to do this. Rashi over here and the Bali Tosafot seem to indicate otherwise and say that we don't allow you to bring another animal. It must be done on another location along the trachea. And that you have to take that same trachea and cut it again and see if the cut that you do then simulates the cut that's there. If it does simulate the cut that's there, then you know that the shechita was done after it was shmuta, after it was already detached. If it looks different, that means that the original cut was before it was shmuta, and therefore it looks different over here. So that's the attempt here. Compare it or contrast it with either Yavi means another animal, or again, the Tosafot and Rashi seem to push back against that idea and say that simply not Yavi, and some of them had a girsa that did not even have the word Yavi in it, but simply Yakif. You compare it along that same trachea, you make another cut to see whether it looks the same or looks different. He says that the Yavi here clearly does not bring another animal. He says, if you have the girsa like we do of the word Yavi, it's a little hard because it sounds like you're bringing something externally to check it. So either you have to say that the girsa was not Yavi or he had a girsa without it, or if you do have that girsa, you have to say Yavi doesn't mean literally bring a new animal, it just means bring before us whatever is there, cut the trachea, not bring a new animal in to do the check, according to the Bali Tosafot. There were Gaonim who believed that you could bring another animal in, and that's what Tosafot's responding to, and saying that he doesn't think that's right, and then Tosafot's rejecting that idea, or rejecting that possibility. The Bali Tosafot over here make a second note, which is, you can't do this with the esophagus. Because by the veshet, by definition, they will not be the same. Even if the trachea is detached, a prior scientific problem, which is that if the trachea detaches, and then you shech the animal, it's still a psula, even if you did it on a bird, and you only need one siman, and you cut the veshet. We learned that earlier, that ishmuta is problematic, even if you don't cut that siman. Even if you cut the veshet, if the trachea is detached, that's enough of a problem to be a trefa. So now, what you want to do is, you cut the esophagus, and you want to see if the esophagus was cut before or after the trachea detached. Tosafot says that's an impossibility. The trachea detaching has no influence on what the esophagus looks like. The esophagus could have been cut while the animal was alive, and then you cut the esophagus down, it's clearly not going to look like when you cut it when the animal is alive. But it still will give you no information about the shmuta. It'll give you no information about the detachment of the trachea. Now you cut it, and it looks like, oh yeah, it's different than the other cut. Of course it's different than the other cut. The animal was alive when you cut the veshet the other time. So it was alive, isn't it, kasher? No, because if you cut the veshet when the trachea is detached, it's still a trefa. So therefore, the test through the veshet, there is no test that you can do through the veshet. That's what the Bali Tosafot say. Amar Rav Nachman, lo shanu elish lo tafas b'simanim. That's only true if you don't hold the simanim. Avot tafas b'simanim v'shachat, v'shad shmuta shetaseh shchuta. The question here is Rav Nachman arguing or is Rav Nachman qualifying? The truth is that that would make a difference in the way that it's presented. Amar Rav Yah Nachman is a statement, not necessarily arguing on the previous statement. If you have a girsa of Rav Nachman Amar, then it would actually argue on the previous statement. So there are girsaot that have Rav Nachman Amar and not Amar Rav Nachman. In that case, it would be clear that he's arguing on the previous statements. The way that we have it formulated as Amar Rav Nachman, it sounds like he's qualifying. The question is he qualifying Rav, Rabbi Yochanan, or both of them? His only point is that when you say that there's no such thing as a shchuta, when you have a shmuta, that's only true if you don't stabilize the trachea. So if you don't stabilize the trachea, then you either have the problem of Rashi, which is the trachea is all the way down, or you have the problem of the Rambam, is that there's no counter pressure for you on the trachea. But if you held the trachea, the top of the trachea, in place, then either you could pull it up, according to Rashi, or according to the Rambam, you would stabilize it, and then you could do a shchita, even though it was shmuta. So then, again, if Rav Nachman's arguing on Rav, he's saying that you can't just conclude, because you have a trachea that's cut over here, that that meant that the shmuta happened afterwards, because you wouldn't be able to cut it beforehand. Rav Nachman would be saying, that's not true. Depends if the guy could hold the trachea. If he could hold the trachea, then you could even have a case where it detached first, and you did a proper shkita afterwards, and it would still be a trefa. That's if he's arguing, Rav. All you have in front of you is a cut trachea. What Rabbi Yochanan's pointing out is that there's another way to get a cut trachea. That means after the fact, they went, they pulled up the trachea. After the animal's dead, after the shechita was done, they cut through the neck. They pulled it up and he cut it. That's why there's a cut in the trachea now. There's a nice cut in the trachea because he was able to stabilize the trachea with his other hand. All you have in front of you is a cut trachea. So now, according to Rav, that means it has to be that it was attached afterwards because you can't cut a trachea unless it's attached. Rabbi Yochanan says, I can simulate the effect of being attached and still cut it afterwards. And that's the problem. You're cutting after the fact. And so now, just because I have a cut trachea in front of me doesn't mean that it wasn't shmutah beforehand. If he's qualifying Rav, he's just saying that when Rav says that shmutah v'shchutah is ksheira, is only in a case where it's impossible or there's no ability for him to grab onto the trachea. Meaning that there was no evidence of anybody holding or wasn't open enough for him to hold onto the trachea. In that situation, it would be true. But in a case where that's not true, where there's an ability to grab the trachea or hold it, then you could have a shchutah that was shmutah already, and it would be a straightforward. You can't automatically conclude that the animal is ksheira. Right, so now we're finally at the tail end of the Mishnah, then the beginning of Elu Trefot, which is Zeklal. This is the principle. That was the principle laid out in the Mishnah, that anything that if you had this problem, the animal would not survive, that's considered to be a trefa. The Gemara wants to know, Latuye Mai, what does that come to include? The Gemara says, Latuye Shav Shemaitata, to include the 7 Memrot of the Amoraim. This goes back all the way to the beginning of the Perek, where the Gemara asks, is it really true that these are the 18 trefot that there are? Weren't there more trefot? Over there, the Gemara brought down Pasgar, which were the 4 Memrot of Tanaim inside of a Braita, or inside of a Mishnah, that we wanted to include, and then the Shav Shemaitata, which were 7 trefot that were set over by Amoraim. And then the Gemara went through the trouble then of trying to move around different trefot in order to get to the number 18. And in doing so, it uses the Zeklal to include those Shav Shemaitata, because they're not mentioned explicitly in the Mishnah, but we're going to include them through the Zeklal plus their notable comparisons to some of the things that are there. So here the Mishnah Gemara just mentions Shav Shemaitata, but the truth is that it probably includes Basger as well. The Bay Yosef Rishba, so the individual Yosef the fowler, I mean the person who used to hunt animals, used to hunt birds, Machu Begida Nashio. They used to hit, whether it means here they shot an arrow, or they used to hit with a stick, they get an Asher, the sciatic nerve, because an animal died. Atu the Kamei Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira. So they brought up this issue with Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira and says, why isn't this considered to be a trefa? It's clear here when they hit the sciatic nerve, whether they shoot with an arrow through it, or whether they hit it with a stick, the animal dies afterwards. If that's the case, it should be negdar ketreifa. Amar lo, mechila hosif ala treifot yesh. How can we add on to the treifot? In the chalama shemanu chachamim. Whatever the chachamim listed, those are treifot. We don't add to the list. We don't subtract to the list. This becomes a rallying cry in the Rishonim as science starts to develop in the Middle Ages and then later on. This becomes some of the tshuva that you see from the Rishonim and even the Achronim discuss this memra over here, which says that we can't change trefot that are already enumerated. Just because now science tells us this is a trefa, or the Chachamim tells us a trefa and science tells us it's not a trefa, that's not going to change the facts that the Chachamim gave us, and that's the Misora. How you deal with that is somewhat difficult because we've learned new things. We have abilities to deal with it. We'll see in the end of the Gemara here, there might be an answer to that a little bit. But the way that the Michtav Eliyahu deals with it, he quotes it towards the end of Chelek Daled and the Michtav Eliyahu, but from a letter from someone asking him about this issue, he says that the halacha of the Moshe Mitzrayim is that the Chachamim have that these are trefot. They take those trefot, and then they connect them to the science of their times, which means they have a Masorah about a trefa, and then they try to bring understanding to it based on the science of their times. But the science of their times is not the reason for the trefa. The trefa is a trefa because it's halacha, the Moshe Mitzrayim. That halacha Moshe Mitzrayim is driving. And then the science that they purport to connect it to is, yes, that's somewhat fallible because they're just connecting it to the science of their times. But that doesn't change the Mesora, which is the fact that these items are always considered to be trefot. And other items that you bring in are not trefot. So that brings up issues that are spoken about, maybe more debated in the last century or two, about how do we deal with the advancements in sciences and how that interacts with what we know here from the Gemara in terms of trefot. So there are tshuvos from Moshe Feinstein, from the Chazon Ish, all trying to reconcile or deal with some of these differences, some of these issues, and still maintain the integrity of what is halacha, the Moshe Sinai, with regards to these issues. It definitely still remains a hot topic, and it's something that's probably worthy of a lot more investigation and a lot more work in order to bring clarity to these issues. So here, question whether it's Rav Papa Bar Abba or Gwei the Bach changes it to Debay Rav Papa Bar Abba. Because over there, if you change it to Debay, then maybe it's not a halakhic question. So if you think it's a halakhic question, these people actually wanted to do Shechitah. They wanted to somehow stop the animal and then do Shechitah before the animal died. What ended up happening was that the animal died before they got to do the Shechitah, which tells us that whatever they were doing made it fatal at the time. If you think they were just trying to kill the animal, why didn't they just kill the animal? Why did they were such good archers? They were able to shoot it right through the kidneys, let them shoot it through the heart, and the animal would die that way. The fact that they were doing this seems to indicate that they were trying to somehow tame the animal, or bring the animal to a point where they could shecht it and make it into a kosher Shechitah. But it was failing because they were dying before they were able to do the Shechitah. So again, it would have to do with whether these fowlers were maybe halakhically oriented or not, and that might have to deal with whether you think it's Rav Papa Bar Abba or is the Bey Rav Papa Bar Abba, as to whether maybe there's a halakhic issue over here. So then again, they used to hit the kidneys, and the animal used to die from that kidney injury. That's true by human beings, that if the kidneys are taken out of a human being, they won't last very long. They're going to die from blood poisoning in a very short time. It happens to be with ruminants that they have an alternative system in their carcass, in the rumen, that gives them the ability to even survive without kidneys, at least for a certain period of time or a fairly decent period of time. And so it's not necessarily true just because there's a kidney injury that the animal should die. After the Kamei to Rabbi Abba, they came before Rabbi Abba, Amar Lahu, he said to them, Chilo Siva la Trefod Yesh, again, the same refrain, which is, you're going to add on to the Trefod, in the Chalama Shemanu Chachamit. You only have what the Chachamim enumerated. We see they are dying. They're dying from this thing. We have empirical evidence that there's a problem here. It's Gemiri, the Badri law, Sama Chayo. We have a Mesora, or we have a belief that if you treated it medically, the animal would survive. And therefore, even though maybe it is a trefa from the standpoint that if this injury happens, then it hurts the animal to the point where it would die, but we have a Mesora that those types of injuries or those types of problems are fixable and they can be treated medically. Since they can be treated medically, they're not considered to be fatal. They're not considered to be trefot. So again, that is a partial solution to the problem here, because then it says the reason that these aren't considered trefot, even though they're fatal, is because they are treatable types of trefot. But then that opens up Pandora's box, which is if today we can treat some of the trefot that the Chachamim enumerated, does that make them not trefot anymore? So he says they have a Mesora. This is part of the Mesora of what are considered to be treatable trefot and not treatable trefot. And again, this is up for much debate in the post-scheme as to how far we can take this or what are the implications of what are said here. According to most, we stay pretty close to what the trefot of the Chachamim are, because that is a Mesora. It's a Lach of the Moshe Mesinai. And therefore, those are the Gedarim that we have, despite maybe what we think today or what we can do today. What's interesting here is that both instances where they said the animal died, the truth is that they're not fatal in nature. Again, taking out the kidneys in a ruminant is not necessarily fatal to the animal. And hitting the sciatic nerve is also not something that's fatal unless you hit a major artery over there for whatever reason and that caused the animal to bleed to death. But otherwise, it shouldn't be fatal. So here it happens to be that the Chachamim's response might have been correct, which is these aren't necessarily fatal and they're not trefot. It happens to be that it's happening in these animals, but that's just not the case. It's not something that is really a trefa. Right now we bring the next Mishnah, which is the contrast to the first Mishnah in the Perek, which is the first Mishnah began, Elu trefot. These are the trefot. Over here, the Mishnah begins, Elu sherot. These are the things that are kosher. The Bali Tosafot back on Membet discussed, why do I need a Mishnah to tell me what's kosher? Most of them are a derivative. Or if you contrast the first Mishnah, you would know this. You could be mitayek from the first Mishnah and end up with whatever is written in this Mishnah. So Tosafot back there goes through each item and explains why there's a chiddush on either side, why it has to be repeated over here, even though it's just a contrast to that which is in the first Mishnah. Veluk sherot bebehema nikva hagargeret. If the trachea is punctured, the trachea by a nekev is not enough. By a veshet, a nekev is enough to make it into a trefa. By the trachea, depending what you have here, nikva, if it just has a hole in it, it's not going to be a problem. There we said that in order for it to be a problem, if it's across the circumference of the trachea, I mean, cut width-wise across the trachea, you need rove in order for it to be a problem. And that's because, as Rashi explained back then, that when you have rove across there, the tension on the trachea is going to cause it to tear away totally because there's a lot of pressure and you've cut it along the width of the circumference of the trachea. Onistika, if it has a crack in it, that crack is also not a problem. This we discussed in the Gemara as well, and Rashi noted this as well, which is that if the crack is along the length of the trachea, then it's not a problem as long as you have one, either tracheal ring or, according to Rashi, three tracheal rings at the top and at the bottom. That's enough to secure it. And here Rashi explained that here the tension goes in your favor. Because here when you extend or you pull on the trachea, it actually causes the tightening of the trachea and the crack, and therefore it's actually better and it works in your favor. Before the tension, when it's sliced across the width or the circumference, the tension pulls against that and causes it to tear more. Over here, the tension works to shrink the trachea when it's being pulled. That means that the sedek, the crack, is going to be sealed up. And that's why it's kasher. Ad kama texar, how much can the trachea be missing and then be problematic? This is not where it's cut across the width or the circumference, but rather cut longwise, or there's something missing on the length of the trachea. How much needs to be missing? Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, ad ki isar italki. Again, we've discussed this before. It means up to the size of the Italian isar, which is 1/24th of a dinar, and is a small copper coin that was used for measurement. Nifchata hagugolet. If somehow the skull was broken down, it was injured in some way, but baloni cave krum ha-shamoach, but the membranes of the brain were not punctured. We spoke about this before, that the meninges, which is the protective layer of the brain, sits below the skull. You have the upper area, which is the skin and the flesh that are on top. Then you have the skull, which is the hard cover. And then below that, you have the meninges, which have three membranes there. The Gemara only recognizes two of the membranes. We discussed that earlier. But those two membranes, if they're intact, then it's not a trepha, even though the skull has been cut open, even though the skull has something missing from it. We have to reconcile this with the Gemara coming up, which quotes the Mishnah from Olot, that says that when it comes to a skull that is missing something, there we said that if it's missing a certain amount that it can't live, then it's considered to be a trepha. Well, how can you be missing anything and it can't live and be a trepha? Over here, you could be missing the whole skull. As long as the membrane's intact, then everything is fine. So you either have to reconcile and say, here it's talking about less than that amount that is missing from the skull, versus what's said in the Mishnah in Olot. Or you have to say, when Rosh Shmuel qualifies that Mishnah, says v'chein l'treifa, he's only speaking about the spinal cord and not the head. Although it's very hard to say that based on some of the Gemaras, where it seems that the v'chein l'treifa has application to the skull as well. So easiest way to reconcile is to say here, either the skull doesn't have a hole in it completely, it's just nifchata, it's been worn down, but it's not completely gone, or it has a hole in it that's less than the requisite size that is stated by Beit Hillel. Nikev alei velo beit halolo. If you have a puncture in the heart, again, the heart is a very thick muscle. If you have a puncture in the heart that doesn't reach to one of the chambers of the heart, that's considered to be kasher. Again, Tosfot over there said the chiddush is, even though this is a deep penetration, a deep hole, you would have thought maybe that's fatal. Nevertheless, until it reaches one of those cavities, it's not considered to be a trefa. Nishpura hashidra velo nifsaka chuchela. If you have a broken vertebrae, a broken spinal column, but the spinal cord is intact, then that animal's fine. Because the problem with the spinal column being broken is that we assume there's a problem with the spinal cord. The real trepha is the spinal cord, not the spinal column. So if you have it where the spinal column is broken, but the cord is intact, then it's fine. Nikla kaved v'nishtar men of kezayit. If the liver is taken out and there is a kezayit left of it, that is considered to be kshera. That is in stira with our first Mishnah that said that nikla kaved entirely, then it's a trefa. The implications from the Mishnah were that that means that if any amount of the kaved was left, it would have been kshera. And the Gemara brought that stira and said that they are two authors. The Mishnah there and the Mishnah over here are authored by two opinions, and they disagree. And there is an opinion based on the first Mishnah, which is that any amount of the kaved liver that's left over is enough, versus over here where it says you need a minimum of a kazayit in order for it to be ksheira. Hamseis ubeta kosot, the omasum and the reticulum Shenikvu ze letoch ze, that are punctured one into the other. Rashi over here notes that they, first of all, they're right up against each other. The organs are adjacent to each other. And they actually physically open into each other. The food passes from one to the next. It goes from the reticulum to the omasum. And therefore, that's the natural flow of food. So if you have a hole from one to the other and the food's going to flow through there, there should be nothing wrong because that is the natural occurrence anyway. And therefore, it is kosher. And again, that's in contrast to in the Mishnah before where it says that they were punctured lachutz. They were punctured to the external side where it is a trefa. Here where they're punctured to the internal side, one into the other, then they are considered to be ksherim. Nitalatzpo, if the spleen was taken out, this is in contrast to what we saw before, that the tkol, the spleen that has a hole in it, or a puncture in it, is a trefa. But if the tkol, the spleen is gone entirely, then it's fine. Nitlo aklayot, if the kidneys are gone entirely. Nitla lechia takton, if the lower jaw is gone. Assuming here that the simanim are still in place, there's no ikur simanim. And again, we discussed this earlier in the parak, that the basar, the flesh, or other items that are around there hold the simanim in place, despite the fact that they've been detached from the lower jaw, which really gives them their stabilizing force. So here, when the jaw is out, if they are stabilized in place, there is no ikur simanim. Nitnaya ha'im shela, if the womb of a female animal is taken out, it also is not a trefa. Bicharuta bidei shamayim. And if it has a sclerosis, which is, as the Gemara describes, a drying out of the lungs. But now we have it bidei shamayim, which happened naturally, and not bidei adam. It wasn't caused by human intervention or human fault. Now, it doesn't mean that it was congenital over here. It means that something happened in nature that caused this problem. And there was a belief that sudden fear caused the animal's lungs to dry out. Meaning that if it heard thunder or heard a very loud noise, if that noise was a natural noise, like thunder, then it could cause hardening of the lungs, but it is something that can return to its former self. It will regenerate or recuperate from that problem, and therefore it's not considered to be a trefa. If the noise or shock was caused by a human being, for instance, a gun was shot in front of the animal, or some other noise was made in front of the animal that caused it to be afraid and caused the lungs to dry out, that's bidei adam. And bidei adam, it never recovers, and therefore it would be a trefa. So that's the statement over here, b'charuta bidei shamayim, that the lungs are dried out like the branches of a palm tree, and that sclerosis is only true when it happened bidei shamayim, that it's kosher. If it happened bidei adam, it would be problematic. Hagluda, if you have an animal that's missing all of its external skin, either because it was worked so hard that it was rubbed off, or because it has some sort of disease that's causing that problem. Rabbi Meir Makshir, Chachamim Pusim, Rabbi Meir says that's fine. Chachamim say it's a problem, a pasul, and again we'll discuss it later. This was discussed back by the Bazger on Membet with regards to the inclusion of additional trefot, including this trefa of Rabbi Meir. Itmar, Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Evu trefot davka, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish Amar, Evu ksherot davka. So you have a machloket here. You have the word elu that appears in these two mishnayot. Generally, elu is an exclusive term. It says these and nothing else. The problem is now that you have two mishnayot that are contradicting each other. You have one that says, here's the exclusive list of trefot, implying that anything else is kasher. Then you have a mishnah over here that says elu ksherot, saying that these are the things that are kasher, implying that everything else is pasul, or everything else is a trefa. So now how do you reconcile between the two? So Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish basically argue about which one is dafka and which one is lav dafka. Which one means elu exclusively, and which one is brought down just agav. Because the other one says elu, they just made them parallel in structure and say elu, but it doesn't really mean elu. In the end, it seems that the argument may not be based on this, but may be precipitated by a disagreement about another matter, as we're going to see in the Gemara in a second, and therefore this is just an additional way to deal with it, or layer it on top, but this is not the real reason for their positions. And we'll see later on why that might be an appealing way to explain what's happening over here. So Rabbi Yochanan says, Elu Terefot is Davka. Shimon Lakish says, Elu Kishiro Davka. But my Kamifligate, what are they arguing about? What is excluded or included based on this Machloket? So they're arguing with Rav Matno. Dama Rav Matno, Haibuka de Atmo, the Shafmi Duchte. So this is, again, something that we've discussed before, and we saw it back on Membet. The girsa over there was brought by the Oroch to be not Bukha, but Buchna. which we discussed before. That is a ball and socket joint. It's like the pestle and the mortar. It's a ball and, which is equivalent to or very similar in look to a ball and socket joint. And they're speaking about the hip joint at the top of the femur where it dislocated. So that dislocation is considered, according to Rav Matna, to be a trefa. Rav Yochanan Amar, Elu Trefeot Davka. The reason that the Mishnah said these are the trefot, Trana trefot, Betana Zeaklau. It says the trefot, and at the end of the Mishnah it says Zeaklau. The Chazi the Rav Matna, the Achib is Zeaklau. And then the Tana realized that if I just leave it like this, Zeaklau is going to include something like Rav Matna, who says that that's a trefa. My Daima, why would you include it? The Dami al-Nitule. This is similar to in our Mishnah categories that we had before, including one of the categories was Nitula, something that's taken out or missing. So as we note over here, this is similar. A dislocated hip is similar to being missing. It's out of place. It's as if it's missing from its location. So I would have included it in the Zeklau because it's similar to the Trefot enumerated in the Mishnah. So Tana Elu Trefot. Therefore the Tana said Elu Trefot. Hani Yud Trefot Ramadnak Shera. To come tell you that that's an exclusive list. And these are the things that are trefot. Rav Matna's trefa is not really a trefa. And therefore Rav Yochanan believes that Elu Trefot is Davka. And that comes to exclude Rav Matna and to say a dislocated hip is not a trefa. Shimon Lokesh Amar Elu Ksherot Davka. He says that the Elu Ksherot is Davka. Tano trefot Vatana Zeklau. The first Mishnah that says the trefot and says Zeklau. This is the general principle. B'chazi the Rav Matna the Lo Achib is Zeklau. And he saw that Rav Matna was not going to be included through the Zeklau. It would not be included in those things that are enumerated as trefot. My daima. What's the reasoning? Because it's not similar enough to all the items there. Lavne nikuve damya. It's not like things that are punctured have a hole in them. Below the psuke damya. It's not like things that have pieces missing from them. Like the spinal column or the trachea. Ule nitule nami lo damya. It's not like items where they're completely missing. Like the spleen that's taken out or the liver that's taken out completely. It's still there. It's just dislocated from its proper place. So therefore, Tanu Eluk Sherot, Hani Udik Sherot, these items exclusively are kasher, Had Rav Matna Trefa. But Rav Matna's din is really a Trefa because it's not included in Eluk Sherot. And therefore, it is included in the list of Trefot, even though it's not similar to any of the other Trefot. It's included because it's excluded by the Mishnah that says Eluk Sherot. So that is how the Gemara posits their machloket about Rav Matna being influenced by what they say about Elu Trefot and Elu Ksherot. The Bali Tosfot say over here, why don't they argue about Rachish Bar Papa? We already had before this view of Rachish Bar Papa, that Rachish Bar Papa said that if you have a diseased kidney, that that is a trefa. And over there, back on Mem Gimel Amud Aleph, we said that Ula listed the 8 trefot over there, and only things that are similar to the categories that are mentioned in the Mishnah are subsumed under the Zeaklau, and therefore Rochish Bar Papa was excluded based on that. So now Tosafot says, from here it sounds like both Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish agree that if you have something that is similar to what's in our Mishnah, then you're included by Zeaklau. If you're not similar to something in our Mishnah, then you wouldn't be included by Zeaklau. And seemingly they would agree, like Ula, that Rochish Bar Papa's din is excluded as well. Because it's just not similar to any of the items that are there. So that Rachish Bar Papa argues on Rabbi Yochanan, Reish Lakish, and Ula, and says that even if you're not exactly like one of these categories, you can be included in the Zeaklau. Or Tosfot offers the possibility that maybe he holds like Reish Lakish, that Eluk Sherot are Dafka, and therefore he's able to include from Eluk Sherot also that, like Reish Lakish included as Rav Matna, Rochish Bar Papa could include his din of a kulia, a kidney that is diseased. But then Tosfot says, then why didn't the Gemara say the machlok between Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan is about Rochish Bar Papa and not about Rav Matna? So Tosfot in the end gives an answer of Yishlo Omar, the Kimle, the Masadar Ashas, the Peligibi, the Rav Matna, that the Gemara or the Masadar Ashas had an inkling that their machlok was about Rav Matna. And that's what goes to what I said before, which seems to be that it's not that the Elu Trefot and Elu Ksherot are precipitating their difference in opinion, but it's rather their difference in opinion about Rav Matna influences what they say about Elu Trefot and Elu Ksherot. Or in other words, the Gemara is just trying to build around this machloket about Rav Matna another machloket to explain the Elu Trefot and Elu Ksherot. Because as the Bali Tosafot point out in other places in Shas, it's not always true that the word Elu is exclusive. Sometimes it's not. Especially in situations where you have a stira between two Mishnayot, like here, You wouldn't say that the elu then means exclusive term. And therefore, it seems that the Gemara is just building that elu. It's not the primary reason for their machloket. The primary reason for the machloket is because they disagree about Rav Matna. And because they disagree about Rav Matna, they try to use the Lashon HaMishnayot, or the Gemara tries to use the Lashon HaMishnayot to explain their positions in a more fundamental way, rather than simply an argument about whether Rav Matna's statement is correct or not. Now Gemara says, Gufa. Well, this statement of Avraham Matna, I Bukha, or Bukna, again here you see the Orach, says Bukna, the Atma, the Shachan, the Gudei, Treifa. Rav Amar Kshira. So here we see there is a dissenting opinion over here. Rabbi Yochanan Rish Lakish clearly argue about this, and Rav is of the opinion that Rav Matna is incorrect, and it is Kshira. V'i Ifsik Nibe, Treifa. If the ligaments are detached, then even Rav agrees that it is a Treifa. V'ilchata, and the locha is ifsig namik shira. Even if the ligaments are detached, it is still shira. Adimit achla it akule. Until it was totally worn down, or as Rashi says there, near kav. It decomposed completely to the point where there's nothing left in there in the socket. There is no soft tissue in the socket. As to which ligament we're speaking about, there are actually two ligaments in that hip joint, in that ball and socket. There's an internal ligament and an external ligament. So Rashi says that the ligament we're speaking about is the internal soft ligament, the one where the actual ball in the socket is. There's a ligament from the top of the ball into the socket itself. That's the ligament we're speaking about. The Rambam, on the other hand, believes that we're speaking about the external ligament, which is from the hip bone to the femur. There is a ligament that attaches between that holds them on the external side. And that's the ligament that we're speaking about over here, where the Gemara says, if it was cut, it would be, according to Rava, a treifa, and then the hilchotai wouldn't be a treifa, that elim kein near kav, until it's been totally decomposed, then it would be a treifa. Now the Gemara says, ad kama tachsar, how much needs to be missing? So that we said in the Mishnah, isar italki, but that assumes that you have an Italian isar that's available to you. What happens if you don't have an Italian isar? How do we then get a measuring guide? We don't have such a coin. So Amar Ziriri Atundalo Mit Chame Lechone Shiura. For you who doesn't have access to or hasn't seen an Isar Italki, so you don't know how to measure such a sizing, Shurei B'dinara Kurdina, that you should then check it with a dinar, that is a Kurdinayin dinar. Rashi over here claims that is a coin that was from Hare Ararat, which is from the areas of Kurdistan and Armenia. So it was a coin that came from that area, and that's what it means, Kurdi'ana'a, which is from the word Kurdistan, similar type of word. Others suggest that it's a Kurdina, was the Kuf and the Gimel got switched around, and it really was Gordina'a, which means a Gordian coin or Gordian dinar, which was a series of Roman emperors that ruled for a very short time. There was a father, a son, and then a grandson, all with the same name. Their names were Gordian, and so that would be the Gordian coin that was produced at that time that seemingly they did have access to, and that would be something that's equivalent to this Isar HaTakli. V'havi Kipshita Zutrati, and it is like the small copper coins, Umishtakach Beni Pshite De Pupadita, and it is similar or amongst those small coins or copper coins of Pumpadita. So again, here, the Isar HaTakli similar was a copper coin. It was one of the smallest denominations in terms of coinage. Again, it's 1/24th of a dinar. It was an extremely small coin. And they're giving a comparable coin, whether it was the Gordian or the Kurdistanian dinar, or whether it's one of these Pshite Zutrate, the small coins, the currencies of Pumpadita. Amar Rabbi Chana Pitora. So Rabbi Chana, who was a money changer. Torah means a table, but a table was a sign of someone who worked as a money changer because you exchanged money. You had your money or your coins on the table and people would come to exchange with you. Ilaminai Havakoi Barnachva. So in front of me was standing Barnachva, Rabbi Yochanan. Ubamine Dinara Kordina. The Sha'arei Beitreifoto. Says, Rabbi Yochanan came and asked me for one of these Kurdistanian or Gordian coins in order to use for measuring treifot, like you're seeing over here. It was the equivalent to the Isar HaTakli. By the Mekam Mikameh, and I wanted to stand up out of giving kafod. Here you have a Talmud Chacham was approaching me, and I wanted to stand up, give him honor. Velo Shavkini. And he did not permit me to do this. Amali, shave mini shave. Young man, please stay seated, please stay seated. Ein bale umanayot, rishaim la'amod bifnei tamid hachamim, b'shasho tzukim b'melachtam. That an artisan, a craftsman, is not allowed to stand up before a Talmud Chacham in a time that they're engaged in their work. Now Rashi takes the word rishain over here, which means permitted, meaning that you're not permitted to do such a thing. It's not optional. It's actually mandatory that you don't stand up. So Rashi says that's because they are sukim b'malachet acherim. They are engaged or hired by someone else to do the work. Whether this, in this case, Rashi claims that he was actually taking other people's money and doing money changing to make money and to split the profits with them. So he's working with other people's money. He has a fiduciary duty to these other people to continue to work and to make money. If he stands up for a Talmud Chacham, that's going to distract him from his work. It's going to distract them from what he's doing. And he doesn't have permission to do such because then he's causing, quote unquote, losses or lost opportunity to the people that he's working for or working with. And therefore, you're not permitted to stand up. The Baal HaTosafot point out the word Rashai, permitted, is used in different places in Shas, not always to mean that you are not permitted, meaning that you may not do so. In Rashai, something means that you're not obligated to stand up. And therefore, the Baal HaTosafot, read the Gemara, is referencing even to a regular craftsman, not somebody who's working with other people's property, even if he's working himself. And all he's saying is, in Rashaim means that you are not obligated to stand up. We don't make craftsmen stand up when they're engaged in their work. And he says, similar to the idea that a person is not permitted to stand up for his Rebbe more than twice a day. So Tosafot over there says that, in Adam Rashai La'amod Bifnei Rabo L'Shachrit Varvit, Shelo Yei Kvodo Meruba Mishal Shamayim, not that it's Asur, Elenu Chayav La'amod, he reads the Ein Rashai over there also, not that you're not permitted, but that rather, you don't have to do it. And similar over here, he says that you don't have to get up, and they could even be referring to someone who's doing their own work, but there is no fiduciary duty. It's his own money. He can make his own decision about it. He's just not obligated to do it because he's engaged in his work. And it's clear from that that when he doesn't stand up, it's not because he's not granting honor or giving deference to the Talmud Chacham that's there. It's because he's engaged in his work. And since he's engaged with his work, he doesn't have to get up because that would be stopping his work to get up. Again, obviously, that would be a great sign of deference, but it's not necessary because if you continue to work, it's not a lack of deference to the Talmud Chacham that is there. So Tosafot reads Rashai over here not to mean not permitted, but rather not obligated. As Rashi reads it as being not permitted. Therefore, Rashi reads it about someone's working for someone else who has a fiduciary duty. But Tosafot reads it even with someone who's doing their own work. It says below, is that really true? But not. Don't we have a Mishnah in Bikurim? Kol balei umanuyot omdim bifneihem. That when the people who are carrying the Bikurim up to the Mikdash come in towards Yerushalayim, all the craftsmen have to stand up for them. B'sholim b'shloman. And they give them greetings. V'omrim lehem acheinu. Anshei makom ploni. Our brethren from such and such a place. Bo'achem l'shalom. Welcome to Yerushalayim. Come into Yerushalayim. Amar Rabbi Yochanan mipneihem omdim mipnei tamei achachemim ein omdim. You're right. That's what the Mishnah says there. But you're also going to be medayek from the Mishnah that you stand up for people who are bringing bikurim. You don't stand up for tamidei chachamim. Amar Rabbi Yossi bar Avin, bo re'e kama chaviva mitzvah b'shato. Look how great doing a mitzvah in a timely fashion, its proper time is. Shrei mipneihem omdim, mipnei tamidei chachamim omdim. That for those people bringing up the bikurim, you would stand up. Whereas for tamidei chachamim, you wouldn't stand up. So that means a mitzvah b'shato has such a high standing that you interrupt somebody's work, you obligate them to stand up, despite the fact that that is not an obligation when it comes to tamidei chachamim. When it says mimai, you don't have to conclude that. Dilma kadesh lo tei nimtza machshilam latid labo. Maybe the reason over there by mikra kareem is so that you don't cause them not to come in the future. You know, it's a big undertaking to bring the bikurim up to Yerushalayim. It was a long trip. It was a lot of effort. And if they come into Yerushalayim to a less than stellar greeting, they're not going to want to come again. They're going to feel that it's just not worth it. If they come in and there's a lot of pomp and circumstance and there's greetings and everybody's excited for them, that would encourage them to come again in the future. So maybe the requirement that the Baal HaMiniyot stand up is just a facilitating device to help people come in the future. But it's not because anything inherently about the mitzvah of Mikra Bikurim. It's not anything about Habibah Mitzvah B'Shata. It's simply a way to encourage people to continue to do the mitzvah of Bikurim. We don't have such a necessity. We don't need them to stand up in order to encourage someone to be a Talmud Chacham. And therefore, they don't stand up in those cases. And truthfully, they wouldn't have to stand up in any cases. This is a unique and special case. Nothing to do with any fundamental idea of Chaviva Mitzvah Vishata or anything uniquely associated with mitzvot that differentiated from Kavod of Talmud Chacham. It has to be uniquely. By Mikra Bikurim, we need more encouragement because of the difficulty. And that's how we create or facilitate that type of encouragement. Now we have Amar Rav Nachman. Kisela, ki yeter mi kisela. Ki isar, ki yeter mi ki isar. So Rav Nachman makes this statement that when the Mishnah gives you a shiur, when it says that it's a shiur of a sela means that once you've reached a sela, it's the equivalent of being bigger than a sela. So already, a sela is going to be problematic. Similar to an Isar. Once you reach an Isar, that's going to be the equivalent of above an Isar. So over here, where the Isar Italki is the measurement, once you reach the size of an Isar, that's the equivalent of being above an Isar, and it's a Treifa. Or in essence, what the Gemara is going to say, Alma Kazar Rav Nachman Ad Velo Ad Bichlal. When these measurements are being given in the Mishnah, they're giving you until that level, but not including that level, which means until an Isar Italki, it's Ksheira. And Isar Italki and above is already a treifa. But that means Isar Italki itself is a treifa. And that is ad velo ad bichlau. And the same will be true with regards to a sela. Now Rashi claims over here that the two cases, one is ki Isar, is what's mentioned in our Mishnah, which is kama chaser from the trachea in order to be a treifa. And the issue of a sela, Rashi says, refers to that Mishnah of Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai that we brought up a number of times as to how much has to be missing from the skull in order for it to be not mitame me'ol, and according to Shmuel, v'chein l'treifa, that it also be a treifa. And in Bechorot, we say that how much needs to be taken out of the skull, according to Beit Hillel, means ad shikinatel min achai b'yamut, if you took it out of a live person, they would not survive, and that is kesela. And so the Rashi says that the kesela over here is a reference to that treifa in the cranium. If that piece is missing, that would cause him to die, which is the size of a sela. That's what we're speaking about over here, that sela. And if you reach the sela, it's already a treifa, you don't have to get beyond the sela. So a sela itself is the equivalent of beyond a sela and is a treifa. That's how Rashi explains it. Tosfot brings an alternative view of the Rabbeinu Tam, but says that it's not referencing to that Mishnah in Olot, rather it's referencing to a Gemara that we're going to discuss in tomorrow's daf, regards to the gluda. If the animal's skin is gone, over there it says that it has to have at least a sela of healthy skin that remains. And so it's a reference to that sela over there, not the sela in the Mishnah in Ohalot. And so Tosfot at first challenges both of those positions because it doesn't say the word ad. The whole premise of this statement of Rav Nachman is that when you say ad, ad means until this point, but not including that point. But if the word ad doesn't appear, then how can you be saying until this point? And if you look in the Mishnah in Ohalot, and you look in the issue by the Gluda, in neither of those cases is the word ad appear. The Tosfot backs away from that and says that sometimes even when the word ad does not appear, it's implicit in the statement, and he brings examples of that throughout Shas. But he says that miu akati kasho. So they still have a problem that gluda is talking about a case of kashrut. And based on the conclusion of the Gemara here, that in general we're going to go to chumra, it actually would work out that this wouldn't work. But then Rav Nachman's statement would not be true in the end. And therefore, Tosafot favors saying a third suggestion as what it's speaking about, Mira de Kaya ad Niktar Kesela. That the case here is dealing with something that we saw back on Daf Nun Amud Bet, with something that has a puncture the size of a sela. Then we spoke about the Karis Achitzona, that it has to be up to a Tefach. And over there we have the statement of Amar Gneva, Amar Rav Yasi, Niktar Kesela, Trefa, Shim Timtach Tamod Al Tefach, that it has a cutout the size of a sela, if you then stretch it out, it will become a tefach, which is what makes it into a treifa. And therefore, that's the sela that they're referencing to. The Gemara then challenges this idea, is it really true that we say ad velo ad bichlal? Eitavei rov of the Rav Nachman. Chevel ayotzei min amita. If you have a rope that is extending out of a bed, the bed is made from a woven rope that they used to put across that would then hold whatever soft mattress that you would put on top of it. So it's the equivalent of something along the lines of a hammock, but it's not hanging on two ends. It's actually stretched out on four corners of bedposts. So that was the way it was made. Then you have some excess rope or string that is hanging off the side. And there the Mishnah in Kelim tells us, Chebel ha-yotze min ha-mita ad chamisha tfachim tahor. If it's just up to 5 tfachim of excess, then it's tahor, because the rope in and of itself is not tameh. It's only tameh if it's a part of the bed or it has some other use. When it's 5 tfachim that extends out afterwards, it's just excess rope that has no use and therefore is tahor. My love, chamisha kelamato. Over there it sounds like up till 5 is tahor, and including 5 that it was tahor. It doesn't flip the phraseology and say ad hatefach chamishi. The fact that it says ad chamishat fachim makes it sound that chamishat fachim is included in whatever measure we're saying. Because if you wanted to exclude it, you would have said until the tefach chamishi, not until chamishat fachim. Which makes it sound like including the 5 tefachim itself would be tahor. So my love, chamisha kelem mato. So over there it sounds like 5 is below. The Gemara says low. Chamisha kelem alo. Chamisha is like above, meaning that once you hit 5 tefachim, it already is tameh. Tashma. So the continuation of that Mishnah, mehei vadasara, from 5 until 10, tamei. That is tamei. And as Rashi explains over here, and the Mishnah says, it's because you can use that excess rope then to tie up an animal. Rashi says they used to do that for their Korban HaPesach, zecher to what they did by Yitziat Mizraim. They used to tie up the animal to the bedpost. So when it's 5 to 10 tefachim long, it has usage, and therefore it's tamei. My love, again here, when it says 5 to 10, doesn't it mean a sarakalamato? The 10 is included, meaning that 5 all the way until 10, inclusive of 10, is tameh. It says low, a sarakalamalo. 10 is like above that, which means that from 0 until 5, not including 5, would be tahor, because that is not useful strength. From 5 until 10, not inclusive of 10, is tameh, because then you have a use for that rope. From anything that's in excess, 10 and above, is going to be tahor, because that's excess rope that you're going to cut off, because it's just too much rope. You don't need that much rope over there. But in either way, it sounded like from the Mishnah that the number that we're speaking about is included in the statement of the Mishnah. And then that would have been ad bad bichlau, and would have gone against Rav Nachman's position over here. So the Gemara's conclusion each time is, no, that's not the case. The number is until that number, but that number is included with the next category. So Tashma, Hadakin Shibikli Cheres, Hein Vekakarotehen Vidovnetehen Yoshvin Shlom Mitzumachin. So now, this is speaking about earthenware utensils that had a receptacle in them that were broken. Now, the only problem with that is it says Hein. Hein means even if they are not broken, it means they themselves. Tosfot over here discusses whether Hein should be in the Girsa. There were Girsa without the word Hein in it. Although he does find, even without the word Hein in it, there's other words there that seem to indicate that this is the minimum size for a kli. But Tosfot in the end goes with the idea that if it's a new kli, if it's a full kli, then as long as it has any receptacle, it's mekabel tuma. And what we're speaking about here are broken kelim, the shards that are afterwards, do they retain a status of a kli? And the qualification for that is that if their walls, their bases, are able to sit without being propped up, meaning that they have a stabilized way to stay up, and shuram kedei sichat katan badlog, they can hold in there, in that receptacle area, is enough oil in order to put on a baby, that's sufficient to deem it as if it is considered to be a kli, even though it's a shard of a kli. Although the Rambam does take another side of the position and believes that when it says hein, that is the minimum size of a kli, and that's what it means here, the range of kli, by which kedei sichat katan is still considered to be a kli, is any kli that starts from that minimum standard of kedei sichat katan, because that's the smallest size kli that is mikabel tuma. And you can see that similar sentiment in Rashi when he says ben she'ein atzman in machazikin, or whether nishtabru, and then the residual pieces aren't holding that. So Rashi has a similar idea to what the Rambam expresses, which is that the minimum shiur of a kli mikabel in kli cheres is kedei sichat katan. That's in contrast to the view of the Balei Tosafot over here. Meshir of sichatan vad log. Log is how big the kli was when it originally started out. So if you have now enough that you can do sichat katan until the size of a log, that is enough to deem a shard from a kli that originally could hold a log in it. That's enough to deem it that it's still a kli. So my love log kilimato again. Are we going to assume that the log is like below, meaning it's ad ba'ad bichlau, and that a log would be included? Where it says, lo, log kim ala. Log is in the next category. Tashma. Milog vad sa'a. If the original kli was from a log until a sa'a, birivit, then the short that comes off of it has to hold at least a revi'it. My love, sa'a kelamato. Once again, is it a sa'a? Sounds like it's included. If it's from a log until a sa'a, including a sa'a, that it, the shards have a din that they are a kli only if they have a revi'it that they can hold afterwards. Lo, sa'a kelamalo. It's included above. Mitashma. Misavat sa'ataim. If you have a kli that originally, when it was intact, held a sa'a up to two sa'a, then the shards have to be b'chatzilog. You have to be able to hold at least a chatzilog to have it considered classified still as a kli. My love, sataim kelamato. Once again, one to two sounds like two is included in that category. Lo, sataim kelamato. That sataim is included above. Vahatanya. Don't we have an explicit brayta that says log kelamato, sa'a kelamato, sataim kelamato? So there we have it straight out. That it's Abba Bichlal, each of these categories, when it mentions the upper limit of the category, that upper limit is included in that category. It doesn't go on to the next category. So that goes against the way you explain that Mishnah in Kelim. And in addition to that, it's against Rav Nachman's position here, that it's Abba Loach Bichlal. Here it sounds like it's Abba Bichlal. Hatam L'chumra. And it tells what it says over here, Hashta Chozer Bo Mikol Mashati, right? All the answers, everything we said until now, we're backing away from. Babi kamo Ella. It's as if we just now said Ella. And Ella means the whole reasoning behind Rav Nachman has nothing to do with Ad Bad Bichlal, Ad Velo Ad Bichlal, being consistent about there. There's only one principle here, and that's L'chumra. Over there, it's going L'chumra. And Amar Yubel, Amar Yochanan, Kol Shirei Chachamim Lachmir. Anytime you have a shiur of Chachamim, and you're coming to a threshold of a shiur, we will go L'chumra. Chutz miki gris shel ktamim lakel. With the exception of a stain by a nidah, that's the size of a gris, over there we are mekel. That is because by nidah, midoraita, a woman is only nidah when she has a flow of dam, and she has a sensation of a flow of dam. If she finds a stain on her clothing from the dam, that's what's called a ketem. Midoraita, that's not good enough to be classified as a nidah. Midarabanan, we assume if there's a ketem, that it is a din of nidah. Now, what's the size of ketem that you need to see in order for it to be classified as nidah? So over there in the Gemara, in the Mishnah of the nidah, it uses the kegris. That's the size of a legume. And that is because once it reaches above that size, you can no longer be tole it in something else. Something else that they were speaking about is a makolet, which is a louse. That if a louse was smushed there, it would leave an imprint or a dam of about that size. So if it is that size, that could be possibly something besides dam nidah, we are makil and say she's not a nidah. If it already reaches beyond that point where the circumstantial evidence would lead us to believe that it is dam nidah, over there, midarabanan, she is tmea tumat nidah. So that ketem, that qualification is a kigris. So there we go to hakel because the whole institution of tamim is midarabanan. So then when we have a shiur of the rabbanan, which is kigris, we're going to go to Kula and say that if it is the size of a kegris, it's still tahor. If it's beyond a kegris, only above that is it problematic. But in other situations, like here by Kelim, where it's a dindoraita, then those qualifications, those standards, we're going to the chumra. So the size that's the end of that category is going to be included in the lower category because that's the chumra. And that makes it that you would have to have a smaller residual in order for it to still be classified as a kli. And that's what we're going to do. By all of these things, we're going to go to Chumra. The Gemara says, Deikanami, that should be Meduyak, Tekani Allah Dahai, because it says about that Mishnah in the Kelim, Chamisha Kelamala, Asara Kelamato. We have another, the Braita in the Tosefta in Kelim, says about that Mishnah in Kelim, that Chamisha is like above, and 10 is like below. That's a completely inconsistent. You're not then saying, Ad Ba'abichlau, or Vela below Ad Bichlau. By the five, you're saying that it's not included in the first category, it's included in the second category, that's Tameh. And the 10, you're saying is included in that second category, is that Tameh, and not in the third category. So for one of them, you're saying that level itself is included in the next category. And for the next, the 10, you're saying it's included in the category that it's in. How could you be inconsistent like that? Ella, if you go in the Chumra. And the Chumra means that 5 and 10 are included in that range that is Tameh. So up to 5 is Tohar. Beyond 10 is Tohar, but 5 and 10 themselves are all included in that range of Tameh, because that is the Chumra. And that's what it means, and that's what Rav Nachman's coming to teach us. That in these situations, we always go the Chumra. In our situation here, the Isar and the Sela are for Trefot. And therefore you're going to go to Chumrah, and that means that a Sela or Isar is going to count towards the side of the Trefot. If you reach that size already, it's a Trefot. Below that size, it'll be Kasher. But then Rav Nachman is telling us that that's the din here, the Chumrah, to tell us that whatever is the size of the Sela or Isar already is in the world of Trefot. Tosva does raise an interesting issue with regards to Ad Bechlau, Ad Lo Ad Bechlau. If you say all Shirei Chachamim are Lahachmir, then why by Zman Tfilan, the beginning of Tfilat HaShachar, the Gemara is trying to decide whether the times that are given there are Ad Ba'ad Bechlau, Ba'ad Ba'lo Ad Bechlau. And it should have been obvious from our Gemara, we go Lahachmir, and you should have shrunk the amount of time you have for Zman Tfilah. And if that's the case, it should have been an obvious answer. Why is the Gemara even debating the issue? So Tosava says something interesting. He says it's not always the Hachmir. He says, Yeshomar, De'ika Nami Chumra Do Amrinin Afar Zmano, we don't have a Chumra that you don't say the time is past, V'chayav Adayin Litvalel Kol Shar Revi'it, because then you still have to daven. So he's saying that there's a Chumra Mitzah that you have a longer Zman Tfilah, because then if the time didn't pass, you're now obligated to daven. So he says, not just the Chumra to say that the time has elapsed, there's a chumrah to say the time hasn't elapsed, because that's going to compel you to daven in that case. That's what just says. You have to keep it consistent then. Because then if it's equally a chumrah both sides of it, then it's going to be true by all the tefillot that we say. And either it's all going to be ad bichlal or all lo ad bichlal. Not like we did in the Mishnah in Kelim, where we made 5 in the higher category, lo ad bichlal. We made the 10 ad bichlal in the lower category. And we were inconsistent because there both of them will turn out to be the chumrah, even though it's inconsistent in terms of ad bichlal below ad bichlal. But by tefillah, you have to pick which chumrah you think is the side that you're going to. Or if they're even, you have to keep it consistent. And either they're all going to be ad bichlal, or they're all going to be low ad bichlal. There's a large tosafot here discussing an issue that he discussed in a number of places in Shas, is whether when you have shards in the kli, do you have to designate those shards for that purpose in order for them to be, quote-unquote, repurposed and be a kli? Or does it happen automatically? And so Tosva concludes over here that it's only through yichud, only through designation where you actively designate the item for this alternate use, does it then retain a shame kli that it works. And beyond that, he says that if you take a larger kli and you have a shard that's smaller than that which is mentioned here in the Mishnah, and you designate it as a kli, v'tela dato et zokol adam, we don't pay heed to what you're doing. That's an unusual behavior. We're not going to classify it as a kli. Or maybe even we'll classify it as being a new kli, because it's not doing the function that you did before. Tosafot then goes on to challenge that assumption that you need yichud kli in order for it to be classified as a kli from other places in Shas where it seems to indicate otherwise, from the name of Tumah and the name of Shabbat. And then he concludes that you do need yichud, but there are certain exceptions and certain qualifications when it may need a tikkun, where it does need some fixing along the way. How does that impact on this situation? Okay, we're going to stop here about the two dots in the middle of Nun Hei Amud Aleph.